March 18, 1990, the most audacious art heist of all time took place at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Check out season one of Empty Frames for a 12-episode dive into the Gardner heist.
This season, we will be exploring other art crimes and significant moments in the art world before returning to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist.
This is Empty Frames. Welcome to Empty Frames. I am Tim, being joined by Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I couldn't be better. How are you today, Tim?
Also couldn't be better because we're back. This is season three of Empty Frames. Of course, this is episode one, and what a momentous occasion.
It really is. We did season one all about Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist, 1990 in Boston. Season two was the bridge season, where we focused on other art crimes and moments in art culture. And if anyone's asking why there was such a gap between the seasons, there's a bit of a roadblock when you're trying to get information about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. There's only a handful of people that sort of contain the information. They keep it close to them, and they're the experts, and you have to really do a lot of legwork to pull in information from outside sources that aren't typically associated with the heist or the research of the heist or the museum.
Well, Lance, you're kind of giving our audience a peek behind the curtain a little bit of what we've had to do to produce Empty Frames. And of course, there was another podcast called Last Scene that was done about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. The Boston Globe has written several articles, and they were part of that podcast. So they do kind of have a local stronghold on the story. And again, we've never really talked about this or, you know, the struggles in producing this show, which really is based on trying to help the community recover this art. So this is kind of an introduction to that. And I don't know where this season's going to go, Lance, but our guest here in episode one is quite the boat rocker. His name is Casey Sherman, and he's a really prolific author and filmmaker.
Right. And he is also a local man from Boston, very familiar with the heist, very familiar with the players that are involved in the museum and I guess in a sense the recovery effort. But this is where it gets a little tricky, right? The recovery effort is debatable. They have a particular way, the museum, when I say they, I mean the museum, they have a particular way where they want to recover the artwork. They want it all returned. They have a reward on it. It has to be in reasonable condition and all together. And season three, like you said, is going to be heavily focused on the recovery effort. Season one kind of set the stage for the players. But honestly, at this point, it doesn't really matter who pulled off the heist. What matters is putting those pieces of art back where they should be in Isabella Stewart Gardner, in her home, in her museum that she created. Those things need to go back on the walls and people need to appreciate them. And when we talk to Casey, we're really towing the line of like, what is this? Is this an industry for the museum? Is the board of the museum actually purposely not putting out a recovery plan that is reasonable just to continue this, just to perpetuate the heist? If you have this that you care about, you say that it is important to culture to get these pieces of art back. We wanted to talk about the security director, Anthony Amore. He did the walking tour of the museum during the anniversary over St. Patrick's Day.
The heist walk.
It was a virtual walking tour. The heist walk.
Yeah, is what they call it. And obviously the quarantine has kind of closed the museum, and not kind of. It's closed currently. Hopefully we'll be open at some point. But yeah, so I to your point, they are now really opening up or promoting the heist. And, you know, I think it's a great thing, to be honest. I think they should.
Well, I think they should promote the heist. If you're saying they being the board, I think they should promote the heist, but I think they should also be very open to another sort of recovery effort if they're genuine in their desire to get that artwork back and put it back on the walls. If they're actually genuine about that, they would listen to people like Casey Sherman and Turbo Paul. They fully support a recovery effort where it's a price list. If you have, I mean, realistically, those pieces of art, they're not all together. If they were all together, the recovery would be so much easier. They would have been found by now if they were all together. Those things are spread out. They were used for various purposes. If someone has one, you can simply return it. No questions asked. So there's a price list for it. Here's what each one's worth. That's a no-brainer. you want to get the ball rolling on this, show a little goodwill. And they're not doing that. They're just sticking to their guns.
Okay, everybody. Well, let's play the interview with author Casey Sherman, and we're going to get more into these points in the outro, and we're going to discuss the interview with Casey and all the points that he hits. We'll kind of go over them. And so check out Casey's work. He's written a book called Bad Blood. That was about the Leiko Kenny, Bruce McKay, and Greg Floyd triangle of fate, as we like to call it.
Trifecta of violence.
Yeah. And he's also written a book about Tom Brady called 12 that'll be out in September. And his newest book that is coming out in May, at the end of May, it's called Hunting Whitey, about Whitey Bulger. So check out Casey Sherman's books. He's got a bunch of them.
Yeah, I also want to bring up the book A Rose for Mary. Not a lot of people know he wrote this book in 2003. His aunt, Mary, was one of the last victims, or one of the last victims that Albert DeSalvo confessed to. He was allegedly the Boston Strangler. So Casey Sherman has a direct link to the Boston Strangler, or at least to Albert DeSalvo.
Entrenched in the city of Boston and its culture, he's been working as a journalist for years in the city. He and Dave Wedge wrote Boston Strong, about the Boston Marathon bombings, a city's triumph over tragedy, and that's what they made the Mark Wahlberg movie based on. He writes for the Boston Herald, an institution in town. So I definitely agree that he is a voice that needs to be heard. We are being joined now by author Casey Sherman. Casey, how are you today?
Hey, good guys. How are you?
Oh, we're doing so well. Yeah, great. Thank you so much for joining us here on Empty Frames. Very exciting to have you on for season three, and hope you're feeling well. You recently traveled for your book signings, and we finally got to work out a time to get you on the Empty Frames airwaves. How's everything going?
Yeah, everything's going great, knock on wood. I was in Portugal in the beginning of March, just for a couple of days before the wave of COVID-19 kind of swept across the entire world. So I was able to get out of there unscathed and completely healthy. And I just wish that, everybody at home listening to this is healthy and safe. That's the priority right now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is such a weird time out there right now. And when we were messaging back and forth, you had said that you were traveling, and it was right during that. And yeah, to make it out unscathed is quite a feat. So, and we do appreciate you sending well wishes to the listeners out there.
We've sort of been familiar with your work for a while now. We talked about the story of Leiko Kenny, Bruce McKay, and Greg Floyd, that crazy moment that happened in Franconia, New Hampshire, and your book, Bad Blood, on an episode of Missing Maura Murray that we did a couple of years ago. So that is something that story is very familiar to us. And when we saw that you were writing about the gardener, we were like, we got to get this guy on. We've been sort of talking about you for a while now.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you bring up the Leiko Kenny case, which happened in Franconia Notch 2007. And that was an explosion of violence that you only see, in major Hollywood films. And for it actually to happen in a rural community like Franconia, and the scars and the pain that community still, still has from that particular violent crime, that's what drove me to write that book. You know, there's always a story within a story. And I remember covering that particular case. And unfortunately, I'd covered a lot of police shootings, during my time as a journalist, and they all fit the same script, if you will. Hero cop, the shooter is a bad person, and then with this particular story, an alleged good Samaritan that came in to save the day. But taking a real independent look at that case, it was anything but what it seemed. And I think that's the same case with the gardener heist as well, which we are now, unfortunately getting into that, 30-year anniversary without any real answers to not only what happened, and we're piecing those answers together, over the past few years with a bunch of different investigators and journalists, but more importantly, where the art is today.
Right. That is an important element that people sometimes don't really consider as heavily as the theft itself. When we started covering it in season one of Empty Frames, we found that a lot of people like to theorize about who did it, you know, the getaway route, all, you know, just like the theft itself. But there hasn't been much of a public push for any like logical recovery effort until kind of recently. And I think that's what we're trying to do in season three, and also to have you on to talk about it, is, you know, talk about the importance of bringing the artwork back and showing it to the community again, showing it to the world at large again, that this can be something that's not a true crime folktale anymore.
Right. And, you know, there's a great deal of mythology surrounding a case like this, and it's the ultimate, you know, whodunit with regard to, you know, Boston criminal mysteries. You know, that it's really the last one out there. You know, there was... you know, the hunt for Whitey Bulger, which culminated in his arrest in 2011. And, you know, there are questions about the Boston Strangler case over time, both cases I've been heavily involved in. But the Gardner is really the last one. And, you know, the scary thing is when you reach out and try to get any information from the so-called experts and the investigators on this case, I think they're as clueless as the rest of us.
And why do you think it is that they are clueless, but they don't really seem to... I guess, say that they, listen, we don't know.
Oh, I think it's the, you know, institutional arrogance. You know, I've got a great relationship with the Boston office of the FBI. I've got a book coming out called Hunting Whitey in May, which really is a story about how a small FBI team, after so many years, you know, formed the perfect strategy and cast the best net to ultimately capture Whitey Bulger. So I've got great respect for the FBI in Boston. I don't think that the Gardner heist is a priority for the FBI office in Boston, quite frankly. They've got other cases that they're working on, and these are life and death cases in many, many instances. You know, I lay the, you know, I guess the responsibility more at the feet of the director of security at the Gardner, Anthony Amore, who's, you know, been working this case for 15 long years, and he just doesn't have anything to show for it right now.
Well, you are from Boston, and when we hear those words from people, including yourself, the analogy that's always made is, if you were Bill Belichick and you were coaching for 15 years and you didn't win a game, then people would be screaming for the dismissal. Do you think that that's a pretty accurate comparison?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I actually wrote that because, you know, here in Boston, you know, we look toward, you know, the success, whether it's a sports team or an investigation. And, you know, looking at Amore's track record, and, you know, I used to be very friendly with Anthony and had a lot of respect for him. But, you know, when you do the same thing over and over again and you expect a different result, you know, sometimes it is time for a change. And I do think that, you know, his narrow-mindedness, especially with this particular case, and not allowing other real experts in terms of recovering stolen art to become part of a team, really, to me, you know, is the wrong way to approach recovering any of these stolen art pieces.
Ah, I see. So you're talking about Arthur Brand and not letting him work more closely? Is that who you mean?
Well, I think Arthur is certainly first and foremost in my mind. I've written several articles for the Boston Herald about Arthur Brand and his offer to become very involved with recovering the art and doing whatever he can at this point to get that art back. And I've spoken to Anthony Amore personally about Arthur Brand, and Amore has dismissed him to me, which I think is kind of the wrong approach when you have a successful art investigator who's got a track record of success. And then you have a guy like Amore, who's, again, spent 15 years working on one case and has absolutely nothing to show for it. And again, I think it also comes back to the idea that it's one reward as opposed to 13 individual rewards. And again, you know, Arthur Brand has certainly championed that effort along with, you know, other investigators. As you guys probably know, there's a, you know, former art thief in the UK called Paul Turbo Hendry, who's been pitching that idea for several years now. And to just be dismissed out of hand as if it's the wrong approach, to me, is not the right approach at all to recovering any one of these missing pieces. To think that all 13 are still together, is beyond the imagination for me.
I feel like you could go down two paths with that. You can get lost in these arguments about whether or not the artwork, in your opinion, is all together or why it would be separated. But that's completely different than a recovery effort saying you can return them one piece at a time. And that doesn't matter if they're all together or separate, you know? So I don't see why, like you said, another approach would be dismissed out of hand like that.
Right. And I think it's the proof of life concept, you know, in criminology, where I think that anybody, you know, the thieves themselves, whether they have all 13 or two or even one, you know, they want to see a successful transaction take place, which means, and again, if you read the language in the reward, you know, there are those red flags where it talks about recovery of all the art in good condition. Well, good condition is an arbitrary, you know, piece of language here. You know, the thief may be bringing it back, and these art pieces have been gone for 30 years, not in the pristine condition that they were when they were taken from the gardener on March 18th, 1990. So to think that they're, you know, in any condition that may be labeled good by the art experts themselves, I think that gets us into murky waters, and that may be one of the reasons why the thieves haven't come forward.
What's your opinion on the statement of them being returned in good condition, knowing that some of them were literally cut out of their frames? Like, they're already not in good condition, let alone what's happened to them in the last 30 years. Do you think that's just an impossibility?
I do. I mean, to think that, and you're absolutely right, these artworks were damaged during the heist itself. So the idea, again, that they're all in good condition, to me, is a long shot. I think, you know, that language should be, tweaked or revised. You know, we just want the art back, regardless of what condition they are in. You know, there are art restorers who can work on these types of pieces to actually, you know, get them or improve them enough where they can be put back on the walls of the gardener. But I think, you know, beyond the beauty of the individual art pieces themselves, the idea that the art is returning to the Gardner Museum would help with a lot of healing within not only the art community here in Boston, but the law enforcement community as well.
Yeah. So you think an individualized reward price list is the way to go, or just something to try?
I think it's something to try, and why the hell not?
Yeah.
You know, nothing has worked thus far. And that's, you know, that's been the frustrating thing for me in terms of, you know, where the investigation has gone over 30 years. As I said, you know, I do have a lot of respect for Anthony, but I also understand that after 15 years, there has to be some type of change. And if he's not, you know, removed from his position as the so-called investigator for the Gardner Museum, then the museum should support him by bringing in, you know, legitimate art investigators to help him succeed in his efforts.
Now, when you say the museum should help him to bring in legitimate investigators, is that like the board of trustees at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum? Who would be in charge of that?
I mean, I think that would be the board of trustees' decision to, open up the umbrella a little bit and allow for people like Arthur Brand to come in and work in cooperation with Amore or anybody else to recover these stolen art pieces. It just makes sense. A team effort as opposed to one individual like Anthony, who, you know, unfortunately, Anthony thinks he's the hero in his own action movie or his own suspense movie. You know, he wants to do it all by himself, and that's proven to be a disaster, quite frankly. I think he would be better served to bring in people that have actually successfully recovered stolen art to help him with this particular quest.
Yeah, because your point is that the FBI isn't too active on it, so it kind of just leaves Amore alone. And we do know he's done some writing, he's written some books. You were you going to make a movie with Anthony at one point?
Well, I optioned one of his books, which was Stealing Rembrandt, and I really wanted to just focus on one particular story, which was an art heist at the Worcester Art Museum. And when you're in Hollywood, and I've made two, you know, successful Hollywood films, The Finest Hours and Patriot's Day, and as a producer and a writer myself, you know, what I do is I acquire certain, you know, pieces of material or IP, as they say, and try to develop it. That was a story or a book that we really couldn't develop because all of the information wasn't fully baked in Amore's book. I may go back and revisit that case at some point, possibly with a different team, if you will. But that's what I said. You know, I mean, I've been friendly with Anthony for a long time. I've helped him get adjunct professor positions in Boston. I do like him personally, but when Anthony started to, I guess, jump the shark, if you will, by, you know, promoting and publishing, you know, coloring books about stolen art, I thought, well, here's somebody that may have taken his eye off the ball here, and it's time for a change.
Okay. What's your response to people when they question why you would be the one to say, guys, we need to shift gears here, and maybe Mr. Amore should open himself up to other options?
I mean, you know, again, I'm a voice in the wind, if you will, but as somebody who's a seasoned investigator and best-selling author in Boston, and somebody that knows the criminal world in Boston, you know, my voice is as legitimate as anyone else's. If anybody else has any other theories or options or plans in place, I'd be happy to know about that as well.
So what is your opinion on the Gardner art? Do you have an opinion on where it is or who may be responsible? I know you've done some writing on Whitey. I'm wondering if that connects.
Yeah, and I can tell you, as a matter of fact, it does not. And I'll be able to talk a little bit more about that when the book comes out. But, you know, we've heard directly from Bulger with regard to his possible role in the Gardner heist. And I think that you know, anybody that thinks Whitey was involved in it should probably look, you know, to other possible thieves or organizations that may have the art right now. Now, Arthur Brand believes much of the art is in Northern Ireland and that there was some type of, you know, trade with the IRA at some point over the past 30 years. That could be plausible. I know that, you know, Whitey Bulger had nothing to do with it, but that doesn't mean that the, you know, stolen pieces aren't, you know, somewhere, you know, outside of Belfast.
Wow. So you guys talked to him directly about that. That's incredible.
We didn't speak to Whitey directly, but we have direct knowledge of his, as they said, involvement or lack of involvement in it.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay.
Is that a scary concept? Because I don't know who you spoke to as like the in-between, but just in like considering being involved, and I guess this goes into your history as well, being involved in the criminal element, what kind of adrenaline is that? Like, is it exhilarating? Is it frightening to know that you're about to meet with somebody who's connected to Whitey Bulger or somebody of that ilk?
You know, not at all. I mean, probably my feeling about that would have been different if it was the late 1980s, early 1990s. Where Bulger's power was immense in South Boston, then of course I'd be a little concerned about that. But I lived in South Boston from 1990 to 1992, and I'd, you know, met Whitey Bulger on occasion because he was everywhere in Southie at the time, and I was living right at 10 Thomas Park, which was right down the street from John Connolly's home as well. So it you know, living in that environment. Back in the early 1990s as a college kid, I was going to Boston University. At the time, it wasn't frightening for me. It was more of an exciting endeavor than it was really thinking about, well, am I putting myself in harm's way here? Now, as a professional investigative journalist, I've certainly had to do that on occasion. And there have been times with regard to the Leeko Kenny case that, you know, I was fearful for my life, especially with my contact with Greg Floyd on a couple of different occasions.
Wow, that is something. That's something. If you're willing to come on Missing More Murray to talk about, I think that'd be a really fascinating topic. But Yeah, that's I would never have guessed that that would be the one that you'd be fearful of your life over. That's incredible.
Well, when you're face to face with Greg Floyd in a very enclosed space and nobody else is around, and he is swinging at you with a cane in a courthouse, you tend to I wouldn't say scared, but there's a big adrenaline rush, and you just want to get out of there with your bones intact, so to speak.
Wow. Yeah, I believe I've seen I've seen some photos of that. I didn't realize that. I feel like you were right. You must have been right in that skirmish.
Well, that skirmish actually happened 5 minutes after, actually 10 minutes after his initial skirmish with me in a men's room in that courthouse in Littleton, New Hampshire. So we were alone, and I, approached him because I wanted his side of the story, and he just went off like a bottle rocket and started swinging at me. And, seconds later, after I'm putting up my elbows to defend myself, the judge calls a verdict. He goes out to the courtroom, is convicted of intimidating his neighbor, which is what Greg Floyd was charged with at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember my fellow journalists in the gallery, after I'd only been gone for about 5 minutes and my hair's disheveled, my shirt is ripped, and they're all asking, "What the hell happened to you?" And I said, "You wait." I said, "Once the verdict is read, watch what he does next." And sure enough, they saw full well that he went mad in the courtroom and then obviously in the hallway leading to the elevator, which they brought him down and sent him away. And I remember I was the first person he saw when he got off that elevator, because I'd already seen the skirmish. I'd been a part of it. So I ran down a flight of stairs and met him with the sheriffs as they were dragging him into a waiting car. And we just shared a look together, and I said, "Goodbye, Greg." And he didn't say anything.
Wow. That is incredible, and pretty much exactly what I have thought Greg Floyd would be like if confronted in a, one-on-one in an enclosed space. Congrats for making it out of there.
Well, I appreciate that. But again, that continues to be a story with multiple tentacles, whether, Floyd was involved with the disappearance of Maura Murray, which is what your podcast is all about. I'd certainly be interested in hearing those theories because, this is a very dangerous person. With regard to the Gardner heist, I think you had dangerous people involved in the initial theft itself. I think, there's enough money on the line where, lives could be threatened if people get too close to the art without any brokering of funds one way or the other. So even though it's been 30 years since the Gardner heist, whomever has one, two, or 13 of these art pieces, they should be considered dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. We were speaking with Jenny Seiler, who wrote the book about Miles Connor, and he's often spoken in the Isabella Stewart Gardner heist circles as being someone who, if not was directly involved, might have planned or had maybe contributed to the plan of the heist. What's your thoughts on Miles Connor?
No, I think Miles Connor was a violent criminal, but I think he's also very smart, especially when it comes to art. If he wasn't involved with the direct planning, at least he was an inspiration for a heist like that.
Okay, so you're saying maybe other criminals saw what he did. He was sort of a folk hero in the criminal world back in, the 60s and 70s, and he also robbed the MFA, and that story has been, people take some creative liberties when telling that story. And so you're saying maybe some of these other criminals are thinking like, I can get to Miles' level if we pull something off at the Gardner?
If Miles could do it, so could we. And how much are these art pieces really worth on the black market? Is there a market for, this, type of commodity, if you will?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And on that, what's your opinion on the thieves once they saw the estimated value of what they stole, which I'm assuming they didn't know that it was going to be in that, in that $1 billion range. Do you think, in your opinion, that that spooked them and they might have quickly and irresponsibly either shipped the paintings away, shipped the artwork away, or maybe destroyed them? And the second part of that question is, in retrospect, do you think that the museum should have not informed the public of the value of the art so as to not spook the criminals?
Yeah, you know, in terms of publicizing exactly how much the collection was worth, probably did spook the initial thieves, whether they were working alone or working for somebody else. But I think that they should have kept quiet in terms of how much the collection was actually worth, because then, you know, these thieves would have had at least confidence in their ability to traffic those items. Once, you know, that astronomical number was publicized through the media, I think it closed a lot of doors, you know, for the band of thieves that were behind the heist.
Yeah, and I think it might have closed the door as well a little bit when they came out with the reward for all of the pieces of art to be returned at once. I think that closed some doors as well.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And I think that's why, you know, one of the reasons why we have not seen any of those art pieces up close and personal for 30 years. When you make a mandate like that and you, yes, you're offering a reward, no questions asked, but it has to be the entire collection and the entire collection has to be in good condition. And again, those are the red flags that any thief or criminal, you know, would think about and say, wait a minute. You know, unless there is a different way of thinking here, or you know, a revised set of circumstances, then they're going to keep the art where it is, buried, or in somebody's attic, or in somebody's you know, cottage in Ireland.
And what's your opinion on the Tom Mashburg and William Youngworth storm on the sea moment that happened back in 97, you think that was really the storm?
I go back and forth on that. I like Tom. Tom, you know, if Tom says it was the storm, I believe him. But again, I mean, you go back all the way back to 1997, that becomes part of the mythology and the lore of the Gardner case. Yeah. You know, truth is always stranger than fiction a little bit, but there's a perfect blend of fiction and truth with the mythology around this. So I'm not sure now whether or not that that was the storm.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say I go back and forth too. I think it's compelling, and with the paint chips and everything, I don't know.
Which makes it the perfect parlor game for a lot of people to be playing. But, you know, we can all, you know, through our collective armchairs, you know, wax poetic about theories behind the art theft and where the art is now. But, you know, there's one guy, Anthony Amore, again, whose job it is to find that art. And that's really why I want to apply a lot of pressure on not only him, but the museum, to bring in, you know, real legitimate investigators to support Anthony's efforts and bring that art home.
Yeah. Great point. Well, we did notice that the Gardner sort of rolled out a new feature at the museum, sort of like a heist walk, I think it might be called, where it's Amore in your ears, sort of narrating the heist as you walk through the halls. But they previously really never wanted to talk about the heist or really discuss it at all.
No, that's right. I think, you know, they're smart to market it, because the more, you know, people that know about it, the greater likelihood that, you know, you have enough eyeballs out there, eventually somebody's going to see something. And I think it's smart for them to be marketing, you know, the heist, because, again, it brings a lot of relevance to the Gardner Museum itself. Quite frankly, it was the only reason I ever went there. A great American and global crime. So I'm glad they're doing that right now. And, you know, kudos to Anthony for probably pushing those efforts.
Yeah, I agree. And I would agree that's the only reason I've been there too, even though I grew up in Medford right down the street my entire childhood and everything. Never even knew of the museum until the heist. I was a young kid though. But what a beautiful building. I mean, the architecture and the paintings inside, it's such a beautiful museum.
Yeah, the lore of the heist brought me there, but the beauty of the museum, made me stay there for an extended period of time. And I go back, every once in a while. I admit I haven't been there in quite a while, so I haven't had the opportunity to listen to Anthony's, step-by-step recreation of the heist. And Anthony knows what he's talking about. He certainly knows, every step that the thieves took, while they were there for what was 88 minutes, I believe.
And yeah, 81.
81, I'm sorry. So I think that's interesting for anybody to experience firsthand. And that's like, going on a Jack the Ripper tour, where if you're in the East End of London, it brings that type of criminal history to the present.
Right. And speaking of London, you mentioned earlier that Paul Hendry, Turbo Paul, has his Turbo Plan, which is a recovery effort for all of the pieces of the collection to be returned individually. What was your opinion of him when you first met him? Because Tim and I have talked to him, and it's sort of like getting on Route 1 in Saugus and just going at like 70 and realizing like there's no getting off until the road opens up a little bit more. What's your opinion on him?
Well, I mean, Turbo's eccentric, as I mentioned in a previous column. The characters around a Gardner Museum heist and investigation, they're pulled right out of a Guy Ritchie film. You have a lot of these characters, and I'm always willing to listen to an interesting character. And I think, regardless of Turbo's motives and tactics, I do think that the idea that he first broached, which was the individualization of the rewards, is a smart one.
Yeah, we totally agree. We think that he comes with a lot of energy, and once you absorb his energy a little bit, you can understand where his heart is at. And you're right, it is like all of these characters in a Guy Ritchie film. But he was doing this before Guy Ritchie was making films. He was, I think he called himself a knocker, which was the person who essentially just cases the house, knocks on the door to see like what the interior might look like and where the pieces of art are. And I guess he turned his life around and is working as a liaison. So where his heart is at when he's so focused on a recovery effort.
Well, it takes a criminal to find a criminal in many ways. And, if you dismiss people like that, then you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, in my opinion. You need those voices, to help guide you. And not just Turbo's, but, there are several voices in the Gardner Heist community. Steve Kirchin, who wrote a brilliant book on the Gardner Heist. I mean, he's somebody that's spent a lot of time and a lot of, blood and sweat researching this particular story. And he has his own theories, but, you want to be open to, everybody's theory, because again, it only takes one theory to be right. And you should allow the evidence to lead you and not some preconceived notion of where the art may be.
I'm just curious if you had a chance to listen to the podcast Last Scene, which was the collaboration between the Boston Globe and WBUR. Did you hear that podcast?
I've listened to a little bit of it, but when you're writing books for a living and you're so entrenched in the stories that you're working on, and I've written, now 12 books over the past, 15 years. So I'm always, nose deep in a particular book project. So I've been kind of going in and out of that particular podcast. So I don't have any, real sense of, how well done it is.
Right. And I feel like we can't let you go without asking you about Tom Brady. How you feeling?
Oh, I'm feeling fine. Yeah. We're going to be... I'm reworking our book 12, which is about the redemption of Tom Brady. And that's not a sports story, guys, because I could care less about that. It's really a story about corruption within the NFL, and especially with the NFL offices and Roger Goodell itself. So this was a corporate espionage story, much more so than it was, hey, look at Tom, beat the Falcons and come back from a 28-3 deficit to win the Super Bowl. That's a great way to end a story like that, but but I don't get interested in the story unless there's a lot of meat on the bone. And there's a lot of meat on that bone with, in terms of how Brady was treated, not only by Goodell, but by his Patriot family, Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft. And we're the first ones in our book 12 to really, you know, analyze that and put that to the forefront. You know, I knew this relationship would always end in divorce, and a bitter divorce at that. Make no mistake that, you know, they're not walking away amicable friends here. You know, Belichick and Brady are walking away as the best of enemies, and, you know, both hope to outdo the other next season and beyond.
Wow. So you're specifically talking about Deflategate, or was it a combination of a few things that could contributed to this corruption?
Sure. Well, it was a combination of a few things, but Deflategate started it all, especially, you know, fracturing the relationship between Belichick and Brady. If you recall, you know, Belichick basically threw his star quarterback under the bus, and it was the first time in Belichick's professional career where he did not have his players back. Now, if you really want to analyze the story from a 30,000 foot view, Deflategate was, you know, a minor infraction. It was a speeding ticket, became a capital murder case. The real issue between the NFL and the Patriots all began with Spygate so many years before. And Belichick was able to slip through Goodell's noose because Goodell was very close to Robert Kraft at the time. But the other NFL owners all went, you know, told Goodell in no uncertain terms, you know, if so much as there's a, you know, speeding ticket for the Patriots again, you need to hang him high. And that's exactly what Goodell did to save his own position in his own career.
Wow. So many hot takes here on Empty Frames. Love it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, certainly the soap opera of Brady versus Belichick is really fascinating for me. I know as a sports fan, who's kind of like my fandom, I would say, has kind of waned in the past years, but I do get really into stories like this. I can't kind of get enough consuming the twists and turns of a story like that.
Yeah, it's a story that has great palace intrigue. And I, you know, I'll tell you this, I've written, you know, books about the FBI. I've written books about the CIA. You know, the toughest fortress to penetrate was Fortress Foxborough and the offices of the NFL. You know, we were very fortunate to get Tom Brady to cooperate with the book and the crafts. But, you know, I chased Goodell like a dog with a bone, and he refused to, you know, really give us his side of the story. So we had to recreate a side of the story using a lot of different elements. And, you know, what I always, what I think about Goodell now, is the perfect Nixonian figure, you know, a very paranoid person who believes that he's got enemies and ghosts all around him, and he'll do anything to attain and retain power. And there's also a very Shakespearean element to this story, guys, which is the relationship between Bob Kraft and Roger Goodell. And it was a very father-son relationship for a long time, all the way through Spygate. And then it became adversarial because in order for Goodell to maintain position, he had to metaphorically slay his own father, which he did with Robert Kraft and the Patriots.
That's incredible.
Love it.
I cannot wait to see this unfold in film format. This is great. That is an epic story.
Yeah, no, we're excited about the film project. And we're really gonna look at it, you know, through the lenses of the legal battle that was waged on Brady's behalf. As I said, it's not a traditional sports story. It's more of a kind of a unfolding John Grisham like novel. And it all really happened, which you know, amazes us even to this day. And you're constantly seeing the dominoes continue to fall with regard to what, you know, originally happened through Spygate and Deflategate.
Right.
Now, would you say, in your opinion, that Anthony Amore is the Roger Goodell of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum?
Boy, that's a great comparison. And, you know, as I said, and I hate to say this, but I've been left no recourse in terms of trying to get this this art recovered. I think there's a lot of arrogance there. And I do think that you look at who has profited from the Gardner heist. I mean, the person besides the thief, potentially, that has really profited is Amore. He was a kind of a FAA investigator before he landed on the scene with the Gardner Museum just by answering an ad, and then, you know, rolled out a major public relations campaign to increase his profile. In doing so, he's written a couple of books. I even blurbed his first book, Stealing Rembrandts. But when he starts to, you know, publish coloring books about stolen art, I start to think, wait a minute. Again, is this guy, you know, is his eye on the ball anymore? Was it ever on the ball? Who knows? But it's time for a change either way.
Yeah, well, that's great stuff. Thank you so much for joining us, Casey Sherman. We really appreciate it. And we will definitely link to all your work in the show notes, your book 12 and Bad Blood and, gosh, everything.
Well, I appreciate it, guys. And again, you know, I've got a new book coming out called Hunting Whitey, May 26th. And this is the first and totally untold story about the pursuit, capture, and killing of Whitey Bulger. When I say and killing, you know, we have actually had access to the prime suspect in Bulger's murder. So you're going to see that part of the story, which has never been told before.
Wow. Wow. Well, anytime you want to come back on any one of our shows to serve up some more of those hot takes, feel free. Tim, this might be the first time we've actually had a legitimate Edward R. Moreau Award winner on the show.
Oh, I would say so.
I think we joke about winning that award, but that's just clearly jokes. But
someday,
definitely humbled.
Yeah, you're only as good as your next project, in my opinion. So, you know, I'm very proud of the work I've done in the past and the stories I've been able to tell. You know, you always look at that next mountain to climb, and it keeps you hungry and keeps you active and keeps you focused as well. So happy to join you guys again somewhere down the line.
All right, Lance, that was the interview with Casey Sherman. He was not shy.
Well, I really kind of expected that from Casey Sherman, being a grizzled Bostonian like he is. He really is entrenched in everything Boston, and that's part of the culture. No punches pulled. Nothing that he's going to say is not verifiable. Everything he can back up, everything that he says about people like Anthony Amore, he's said to Anthony Amore, and even says, Anthony Amore is my friend. You know, he's told us that. Anthony Amore is my friend, but here are some issues that I have. I think there should be a time in every case that needs this, which is somebody who's like, I just need to speak out. I can't worry about being polite.
Yeah, and he's written some articles for the Boston Herald, and to your point, he has kind of said some of this stuff. So it comes from a place deep down from him. This comes from a place that he really believes that this should be changed. And, you know, speaking about the recovery effort, how can you disagree? It's really hard to disagree with what seems like no progress. And it's a little hard for us to say, oh, there's been no progress, and, you know, no, for sure, because we don't know. You know, we have no clue, to be honest. I don't know what kind of job Anthony Amore has done. I don't know him. He's never given us the opportunity to really talk to him. So it's hard for us to say he's done a bad job. I can't even say that. But it does seem like, from our point of view, that things should be different by now. This reward price list is the most reasonable thing I've heard. And what's completely unreasonable is not considering it.
So you have to take that and put it into perspective of anything else that has produced nothing since 1990. If your task is to produce a win and you haven't done anything since 1990, yes, it is very unreasonable to not entertain other options on how to produce that win.
And he also mentions Arthur Brand in the interview. And we had an interview with Arthur Brand in season one. It was an episode called Art Brand, which is sort of a convenient name for a fellow who recovers stolen art or lost art. He's like the modern day Indiana Jones. And it's not like I just made that up. Everyone calls him that. He's the only guy that you would say, hey, if someone asked who's Indiana Jones if he was alive today, the answer is Arthur Brand.
Yeah, he's got a track record of recovery that's amazing, from Nazi stolen artwork to, you know, the work that he has done for the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And he's kind of not treated with the level of respect that he thinks he should be treated by the museum.
Well, Amore sort of scoffed at it, is what Casey Sherman said, and is scoffed at the idea specifically of bringing Arthur Brand on to help the recovery efforts. And, you know, just again, like the price list, like the reward price list, I don't understand why it wouldn't be considered. It doesn't really make sense to me. It seems logical. Now, I know everything can't be taken in, you know, but I think there have been a lot of ideas presented in the public over the past few years, especially because of the podcast Last Scene and because of our podcast. And apparently there's a new documentary coming out. So more than ever has there been internet rumblings about the Gardner heist. Internet's still growing, part of the reason too. But these are two boiled down ideas, is my point. And they're really good ideas. I feel like it's just kind of, it's really hard. I can't defend not considering these ideas.
Yeah, it's really confusing to me as well, because what we're talking about is the recovery of these pieces of art. And all we end up seeing out there from the people who are granted access to the information and to the museum, there's only a select group of people, and from the media, like WBUR and the Boston Globe, who produced Last Scene, they were granted access to the information and to the museum. And it's always focused on the usual cast of characters, the usual suspects. It's always focused on the IRA and Whitey Bulger and William Youngworth and all of the cast of characters that just are in this like circle of whodunit. Miles Connor, all in this like whodunit, when some effort and some money could be put towards. And when I say money, if Arthur Brand is charging them money to do this, that is money well spent. Are you going to, you know, if they actually wanted to put effort into the recovery, why are they producing a multi-part limited series on called Last Scene and not putting finances towards Arthur Brand, who's got a proven track record?
Well, who said Arthur Brand's asking for finances? I mean, I don't
know.
Well,
I'm just saying, I'm not his hypothetically agent speaking,
or whatnot, but yeah. I have no idea.
I don't know how he gets paid, but if that's what it comes down to, yeah. Like, well, we can't afford Arthur Brand. Okay, then maybe you should reconsider what you can afford, because how much money did it take to produce Last Scene and to send people to across the ocean to check out a lead that you know isn't going to play out? I mean, you think the IRA is going to be like, oh yeah, that Vermeer. Oh, you're the Globe? Oh, if only the Globe had reached out before. The IRA? No, they're not giving it up if they have it.
I think a wise guy looks at the reward as it's stated in good condition and all the items together, and they laugh at it. I'll be honest. It does. Doesn't it seem like, I mean, we hear it from a former thief in Turbo, and we'll hear it in an episode coming up real soon on Empty Frame season 3. The way it's formed is a joke. It needs to be adjusted.
Yeah. And it was a joke way back in the day when they thought that they had recovered the artwork when Tom Mashburg went to the warehouse in Red Hook, Brooklyn, to see all of these like curled, like rolled up alleged paintings that were stolen from the museum. And he saw the Sea of Galilee, the storm on the Sea of Galilee, which was unrolled in front of him. And then all the art experts were like, that's impossible. There's way too much lacquer on there. There's way too much finish on there. That would have been destroyed if you'd rolled it up. I thought that was put to bed then. Like, these pieces of art are not going to be returned in good condition. They're not even going to be returned in poor condition. They're going to be returned in horrible condition just because, like, you can't keep them for 30 plus years in the elements. I mean, this is from the Dutch Renaissance.
I'm not an art expert, so I don't know what the likelihood of them returning it after 30 years are. I don't know what the likelihood of that, of 13 pieces of stolen artwork are still likely to be together at this point. It seems unlikely to me, but again, I'm no expert. You know who is, though, is Anthony Amore. He's written several books on art recovery or art, you know, stolen art. So this is something that should be put into play. Like, he is a smart guy. You know, he's talented. Yeah. He's written books on the subject
while he's been employed as a security director at a museum. So, yes, he should know. He should be an expert.
So he does know those things. So, I mean, right. maybe he knows that they are all together. You know what I mean? But whatever, it hasn't worked, you know, and it is too bad. I think the city of Boston and the world, they need these back. I mean, imagine the amount of visitors that would visit the museum with them back. I mean, honestly, seeing the empty frame is kind of interesting, but seeing the actual painting would be so much better.
Yeah, you do get some people there that go to see the empty frames, but imagine if you got them back and you put them back on the wall in the condition that they were found, and then you had a retrospective right next to it, like a little digital retrospective. Here's what they looked like before they were stolen. Here's some images of the empty frames, and here's what they look like now. You can see them on the wall. There'd be lines out the door. They would have media there for years. Every anniversary, you could go there. This could be a juggernaut.
And they wouldn't have to be conflicted about sort of promoting or profiting the heist. You know, they can still do the heist walk. This is what happened. It's a fact. That's what happened at one point in 1990.
Absolutely. I will say this. Everything that we talk about with the heist really does not affect our impression and our feeling and our admiration of the museum and the woman who built it. Go to gardnermuseum.org, check out everything they have going on. Once we're out of isolation, if you're able to, get out there to the Fenway neighborhood of Boston and check out that museum. It's absolutely gorgeous. You could go through that whole museum and not look at the empty frames, not even think about the heist, and still be really floored by how beautiful it is.
The artwork is incredible. The building was built specifically to be this display of this incredible collection, this personal collection of Isabella Stewart Gardner. And she lived in above the museum, you know, and it is a beautiful courtyard, beautiful architecture. I agree, Lance. I love it so much with so much of my heart that I want this artwork back. And we're just trying to do the right thing. If we sound frustrated, it's because we've kind of been dealing with some sort of bizarre politics to us, to be honest, in producing this show. And we're just trying to help. And so I hope we're pushing in the right direction at this point. And we'll be back in 2 weeks to push more. All right, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. Follow us on Twitter.
And check out all our shows at crawlspace-media.com. And also swing by Private Investigations for the Missing. That is investigationsforthemissing.org.